My name is Sharon Crane. I'm an alcoholic. Not fair, Hillary. Not fair, Sybil. Wow. Sybil and Jackie, thank you for your hosting. Jackie met me with flowers Friday at the gate because she was there. It was the anniversary of the man that I would have sang that song to if I could have sang. His 5 years of transition, he left me. Gone to the big meeting in the sky. So it was very beautiful to see Jackie standing there with flowers for me on Friday. Oof. And then Sybil said she wanted a room with me, and I thought, oh, okay. I remember the stinky socks, the staying up too late, but she gives a really good foot rub. So and I just think of the history that I have with her. She, on August 29th last year, on my husband's birthday, interestingly enough, Sybil's heart was on my mother's. Hand was on my mother's heart as she took her last breath in Madison, Wisconsin. And I think of what Ram Dass said, we are just all walking each other home. And with so many people in this room that know so much about my heart, that have warmed me, have sat with me, have loved me, have fed me, have smiled at me, have taken the time to call me, have been there for me. I am so full. I know that there's 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the ground, right? 1,000 ways, and there's just been 1,000 ways I have done that with you since I've been with you this weekend. And I want to thank you for that, because I am a seeker. I am about growth. I am not one that stands still. Any of you know my story, that's just kind of how I am. I have that kind of good energy that God has given me. And when I got here, I was baffled. Baffled. Confused. Ember of life. Nothing left to me, really, but just an ember. And it just would have taken one more person who didn't care, because those are the people I was hanging out with mostly at the end of my drinking, those that didn't care at all about life, to just cup my ember, and I would have been gone and happy for it. Because it's been spoken about this whole weekend how deprived we were by alcoholism, how that God ran out my sleeve, how I had to push across the bar my soul for King Alcohol to work in my life. And I come from a loving family. I come from a mom and dad in Iowa. My first resentment at about 6 years old, when I realized I have these siblings. They all seem to not be so emotional. I am more emotional than the rest of them. I am the girl that makes my father stop the car when we leave Grandpa and Grandma's about a block away so I can run back and give them one more hug, because they might die before I see them again. I was tormented. My mind wouldn't shut up. I had that mind going all the time. And I grew up on Highway 1 and the Cedar River Road, with the Cedar River at my back door. And I had an Annie Oakley childhood. I remember I got put on a bus to go see my aunt and my cousins in Illinois. And I had my Davy Crockett hat, my coonskin cap on, because I couldn't figure out what I wanted to be. But I had my Annie Oakley skirt and my little, I don't know, train case of something. Who knows? But I didn't quite know if I wanted to be Davy Crockett or Annie Oakley. But I knew I wanted the Wild West. And I hadn't even thought about alcohol yet. But I have 3 normal siblings, and my mother and father were an alcoholic, and I grew up in a community. My mother was a pioneer woman that got here before the Mayflower, her family, and my dad came from Prague. And we had fun. We had parties and weddings, and we celebrated everything. Funerals, your barn burns down, we're there building it. Your the garden is prolific, and You know, Lizzie Kroll's got extra tomatoes. They show up at our door in a basket. And then, you know, there's no note. We just know that's Lizzie Kroll's basket. So when we have extra cucumbers, it goes back to Lizzie Kroll's door with the cucumbers. That's the kind of community I grew up in. And there was love and peace and joy, and we were allowed to express our emotions appropriately. But we were allowed to express them. And my father had three daughters right in a row and then a son. So he was used to us. My brother said he never got in the bathroom all the time growing up, but but I couldn't wait. There was the call of the wild going. It talked to me at 2 in the morning. It talked to me at 3 in the morning. It talked to me when I was out on the riverbed with my boat trying to get it loose. I called her Liberty, and we were trying to go down the river. And I remember that one day we couldn't go, and the currents were high, And that night then we heard that some little girl fell off the little dam and drowned, and then then they would be dragging the river all night long looking for this little girl's body, and I was up at my window which looked out there and looking and watching and looking and watching because I couldn't sleep because I was just tormented by news. I mean, when my husband and I were married and he used to hear me in the other room going, oh no! So Sharon, turn off the news. So when he was sick with his cancer at the end of his life, for the last 2 years, we watched Family Guy at night. That's what we watched. And so we went home with some. We went to bed with some humor. But I had that kind of, and I told Mary Kroll, Lizzie's daughter, who was my friend, when she said, "Tell me some secrets about yourself." We were camping out under the moon. She and I would go catch turtles. We were good buddies in the country. We were barefoot and out there riding horses and having a good time in the summer. And I told Mary Kroll. I'd maybe told Mary Kroll about being tormented, about, you know, the ghosts in the closet or whatever it was, or that I was afraid of certain things. And I told her the truth, and she didn't talk to me for 2 years. She didn't want to play with me for 2 years. So I learned a big lesson. Don't tell. Don't tell. And I discovered alcohol about 12, 13 years old, and it was the night that I was hanging with the Clark boys, and they allowed me to hang out with them, and I was flat-chested and barefoot and had some cut-off shorts on and my white T-shirt and my trainer bra, and I was looking at all the football players at this Woodsy, and here I am with Jeanette Andrews and all the cheerleaders and all the popular people, and I'm sitting on that 57 Chevy on the front of it, just sitting there looking at Jeanette Andrews with 38 Ds and looking at me and going, "I don't measure up around here at all," and I felt inadequate. But then Canadian clubs started being passed around, and Schlitz beer started being passed around as the chaser. And I got some warmth from that. Now, I had had drinks before. My mother didn't drink. She would push her screwdrivers to the side at all of these wedding dances and things, and I would suck on them. And, you know, it seemed to maybe I could dance a little bit better, but with Uncle Art or something, I could polka. But then there was something that night that warmed me, and I started to look around. I just thought, trainer bra's waking up, get off the car, Jeanette Andrews, I'm arriving. And it allowed me... It gave me confidence. It allowed, you say that? A one voice, let's party. It came down to one voice. Let's, all of those voices got drunk. And they said, let's party. And I had relief. I had relief from me. The bondage I was in with my own mental sensitivities. I'm still hugely sensitive about things. There's so much I want to be alive and know and energy for the world to try to help the world because the world is crying and I know the world needs our help and I want to do more. But I'll tell you, I always wanted to change the world. And yeah, I was there in the 60s. I was marching. I was, you know, behind Coretta King and I go to the moratoriums and just because I was mad. By 18 years old, I was mad at the world. But we have a way to change the world here that nobody else has. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic so that maybe your child can sleep at night knowing you're safe, that you're with us. So that maybe your mother knows when you come over, she doesn't have to lock up her purse. Their father doesn't take away the car keys because that car might be missing. I did that one. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, because that's the basis of what we have here with our singleness of purpose. Recovery we can give because that's the gift given to us to give to another alcoholic. But I can't go out, walk across the street and sit with a normal person and try to change their life. But we've been given that gift. That's how I get to change the world, is by answering my phone, by showing up, by sitting down with a new one, it's been talked about the fifth step and sitting there and watching the relief come through that person, the transformation start. It's powerful stuff what we have here, these 12 simple steps and 12 simple traditions and the 12 concepts, now that you two are the best of friends. Now I know Becky and Ashley are. But my life has been for you. My life is not about me. Don Pritz used to say the most deprived state a soul can be in is to have no purpose. And when I got to you, I had no purpose. I didn't even have a life. I had a lot of chapter threes, and many of you know I went to college. Many of you know I was at the White House when I was 16, a young citizen of America, your future. I mean, there was promise. I played instruments. I had brought joy to people. I was an artist. And by the time I was 18 years old, I was sliding it across the bar at Joe's Place with my fake ID because King Alcohol asked for it. I take my art towel. I want the booze to work. I made that decision. You know, somewhere when I was living in New York City, maybe up on the West End or the Golden Rail, I was working a big ad agency, 2-hour martini lunches every day. It was wonderful. I ran away from home. I ran away from college. I went to New York for the first time, went to the Playboy Club till 4 in the morning, and the musical Hair, and I said, I'm moving here. And I didn't even have to have a fake ID. It was great. But somewhere in there, that's when God asked for another piece of my soul. Maybe it was my innocence, and I slid it across the bar to the bartender, not God, to the bartender. You can have my innocence. It doesn't matter anymore. Alcohol's working. And it was the 60s. It wasn't just say no. It was just say thanks. And 16 four-way hits of orange sunshine. I found truth, but it would melt too often. Oh, there it is. I'm going to try to write it down. It would melt. Oh, my God, there it is. I'd write it down. There was a Rolling Stones record, Satanic Majesty's Request. It was about truth. Truth was there, and I played it over and over and over again. And I wrote down truth, but I wrote down the paper was filled with pen marks because I wrote it down so many times, truth, because I was on a search for truth. I had to find truth. Truth was there. Truth was in New York. Truth was back at art school. I can't paint anymore. I think I'll cut my wrists. That was my solution. My dad and the priest, who was a nice man, came down. We got drunk together, ended up at a sit-in at the student union. Now Sharon's corrupted the priest. Oh, small town, small town. My dad and I sat down and would try to talk. My dad and I would watch the news and try to talk. I've got a Mensa older sister who had a full ride at an Ivy League school, never did anything wrong. I was in her shadow. So I never felt good enough, and that critical self I had my whole life, that critical self that just comes along with me and just tells me things aren't right. You're just not enough. You should have done this. I have a younger sister who knew at 4 she wanted to be a nurse and moved to Alaska, and that's what she did. She knew her purpose. And my brother has a doctorate, and then there's the alcoholic. And so I was always mixing it up. But I used to bring joy. I played the accordion, you know. I mean, it wasn't cool then, and maybe it's still not cool now, but I played that for my father because he was Czech and he played the accordion. And my dad would nudge his buddies as the hay wagon would go down in Solon, Iowa at beef days. And I'd be on that hay wagon, the Boddicker accordion band, sitting on a hay bale with my red pique dress out, my Titano mother of pearl accordion, Italian pulling, I'm playing Lady of Spain. Because I knew my dad was going to be around the next corner. And the boys from Iowa City would be going, isn't that fun girl we were just with? And I would turn so they wouldn't see me because I was embarrassed, but I wanted my dad's eye. I wanted that nod from my dad, that thumbs up from my dad, and now I can't even sit down and have breakfast with him because I goad him into a conversation where all I can do is just yell at him and tell him he doesn't understand and I don't want a thing his generation has. And he would ask me what was wrong when we would have a quieter moment and I would tell him, and my dad knew way too much about his daughter. Amends to make to my dad? Oh yeah. Because he tried to help me. It's like I would let him know about me, he would try to help me, and I wouldn't let him. And that was cruel. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never gotten truth without help. I have never been told the truth about me without a solution. And you taught me the kindness of that relationship of closeness. But I ended up in Colorado, and many of you know I had to slide my dignity across the bar there. It was just something I couldn't live down. And that was just about it. I had to slide my Mountain Man bar in Carbondale, Colorado. Met Bob Dylan and came to California. I think it was Bob. We're not sure. It looked like him. It was Aspen, Colorado. You know, I ended up at a commune. I got kicked out of the commune for drinking their bong wine. They actually took me to a mountain, and we were going on a picnic, and they left me. And they told me to bring all my things that day. I should have known, but they weren't drinkers. They weren't drinkers. I didn't get them, and they didn't get me. And me and the dog, because this other dog, he didn't like to just smoke pot either, so the dog wanted to be with me, so they took the other hyper dog and put him out there with me, and we hitchhiked back to Iowa, where my dad and I couldn't sit at the table and break bread together, because I was an instigator. I'm just going to wait for him to say something I don't agree with so I can just tell him out, because I was so mad. He should have been able to fix me. He had the big shoulders. He was my daddy. But I wouldn't let him. I wouldn't let him anyway. Cruel. And my mother said, you can stay here, just please stay out of his way, because you break his heart, just what you want to hear. So I'd go into the taverns in that little town of Mount Vernon, Iowa, and I would drink and look at the losers in there every night. I'm in there every night. And I met somebody who had an organic farm, and that was the next thing. And so my parents thought, well, maybe this will be it, because we bought 85 acres of organic land in northern Wisconsin. We had a non-insulated schoolhouse that was, winter was coming. we chopped wood. We got the wheat grinder so we could make our own flour, so we could make our organic bread. But then in the summer, we had a half acre of some Maui seed in the back of the woods we planted. And we planted vegetables, too. But they left me by the end of that winter, because it was cold. We all had to hang together in the winter, because I'm a drinker. And I would kick their banjos and look at them and tell them what I thought of them when I was drinking. Because I'm not a nice drunk. I had my heart broken. I shut it down to caring, really. I shut it down. And I had no idea that I was shutting it all down one by one by one, bricking myself up between not just me and you, but me and God. I had no idea. I just knew that alcohol let me not care because I cared too much. Alcohol allowed me to have some peace. Alcohol allowed me to breathe. Alcohol allowed me to run alone. Alcohol allowed me to have that book, Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass, in my backpack and a dog at my heels, wherever I went. Alcohol allowed me to get in cars, hitchhiking from coast to coast. People that were safe, people that weren't safe. I'm here. I'm here. And my mother, you know, many things happened. I joined the carnival. That was something that she wasn't very happy about. But winter was coming. I'm stuck in Wisconsin. I have all this crop. I don't really care about it, but I want some money. So I went to sell my crop, and I forgot it. So I had an interview with Matt Armstrong of Sulphur, Louisiana, for Matt Armstrong Shows, which happened to be in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he sat down with a bottle of tequila, and we drank it, and he said, you're hired. That was my interview. And he gave me a joint, which is a shooting gallery. And he said, be here tomorrow and you can come. So I attached my, I had a trailer hitch on my car. I painted a sun on the hood. It should have written bust me on the side. And I had another dog because those dogs would have a demise because I forget that they were tied outside and they needed water. I was fighting with somebody and they would come try to rescue me across a busy road in Biloxi, Mississippi on Independence Day, and I'm fighting with the love of my life again, and that dog is trying to come and help me, and bam. I'm still tormented by that. I think the people had a choice, but those animals didn't. So I've had to make lifetime amends to the animal kingdom. Lifetime. And if you were sponsored by me and you're whining, and I tell you to get a cat, you better go rescue a cat. Because if not, interestingly enough, one will show up at your door. Because you need a cat. And this happens up in Oregon when I'm in Los Angeles. God, you know, so things happen that are allowing me to continually make amends to the world, because that's, in this step is one of my favorites. Our real purpose, there it is. 7 years sober when I spotted that in the amends step. Our real purpose, there it is. When do they put that in there? Is to fit ourselves, which we know takes a lot of work every day, to be of maximum service, not just once in a while, not just when it's convenient, maximum service to God, first of all, whatever your higher power is, to God and the people about us. And as it's been spoken about this weekend, it rains on the just and the unjust, and everybody gets a shot. You don't see till you see, you don't hear till you hear. And I have had a lifetime with you. I have spent almost two-thirds of my life with you. I got sober on August 20th, 1975. And I am still here. And I wasn't even ready to cut back. So I went to carnival. I end up down south. I end up in jail, Bogalusa, Louisiana, busted for whatever I had in the room. The carnival was sick of me. I was macing the fathers of the kids that were wanting to win teddy bears because I wasn't in the mood, because when I drink tequila, I'm not nice. And I would have to take that mace out of my boot as the fight started between whoever and sneak in a shot in the face of somebody. And those kids were crying because they said they knocked all the targets down. And I said, no, you didn't. And I didn't want to give away my flash that night. So the owner said, get that one. We're tired of her. That Wisconsin farm girl. Let's take her out. And so at 6 a.m., the door burst open. I ended up in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And I didn't have my booze in jail. And so I was having those DTs. And about a week in there, they didn't come back. I was like frantic. Cutting myself with Coke bottle piece. Frantic. Because they're coming in at night and they're picking who they want, but they leave me alone because I'm crazy. I was. Those DTs and crazy. Had no fresh alcohol. And they took me in the cop car, and then they took me to this building and threw me in, and I'm cuffed and unwashed and crazy, and my father's sitting there with a lawyer he hired. And if I have one thing, I'm going to Paris June 30th to visit my son, who's been working there since December. My little boy, who was born in sobriety, who's grown up. And my head always told me, I never drank in Paris. I've been there before, but I'm going to Paris. Not for a program, but to see my child. And part of me is just a little bit worried about that. You talked about that. I really respect all of that and what's going on. I'm going to be with family, so they know. They know. They're happy. They know. And they're happy. My mother used to say, Sharon said, hey, because it's anonymous. She was like, didn't just have to whisper it. But I want to remember when I get on that plane that one day when my dad sat there with that lawyer he hired and his crazy daughter that used to bring him such joy. We couldn't look in the eyes. I couldn't talk to my dad about that day until I was 20 years sober. My amends to my father were ongoing. And you all know I found New Orleans and then it was on. And that's where I gave up most of my soul, because I didn't care. I didn't care what you thought. I didn't care if you were a tourist, or I didn't care if you were a patron. I didn't care. And it started to really show. And I had a boyfriend, where a boyfriend met him at the carnival. That's where the potential is, girls. That's where they have it. He had a pet skunk. I had the new dog. We had a snake. It was insanity. Living in the French Quarter above a biker bar. And that's another day I want to remember when I get on that plane to go to Paris. That I opened that door one morning and my mother was there. She didn't know where her daughter was. My mother sent me a gift every Valentine's Day. My mother always gave me a Valentine's gift. And she hadn't heard from me in a while. And she sent a gift to what the bar was she thought I was working at in the quarter. And it got to me late, but she knew if I got it, I'd call her. And it got to me at the Lamplighter Bar on Bourbon Street. And it was a pretty sweater, I remember, and I called her. My mother didn't sleep at night because she didn't know where her daughter was. They didn't know alcoholism. Nobody talked about alcoholism. We had a town drunk. And I want to remember the look on my mother's face when she was there at the door and black eye and crazy outfit and platinum blonde wig, and my father was there and he wouldn't come in. He couldn't come in. He just, my dad set his jaw and looked at me at the corner of his eye for years. We didn't go eye to eye for years. My amends to my family has been so important, because I, with my mom and dad, because of what has been given to me and the sponsors that came back and sat on the rock with me where I was stuck at some point in my step, took the time to say, okay, kid, you know what? I'm not even going to tell you what's down the road, but I'm going to tell you how you get there. And you will be amazed before you're halfway through. And I had that sponsor, Ginny, come back and sit with me on that rock to tell me how to go about those amends, especially with my father. Because I had gone home at 1 year of sobriety, and I had made the cursory amends to my dad, and he said, I just always wanted you to be happy. And it was great with my mom, and it was a beginning. And I had to go home every year. I had to remember Christmas on time. There were lots of things I did, call my parents once a week. And when I was 5 years sober, Ginny said to me, it's time you paid your father back the money you owe him. I thought, how does she know? I didn't do that big, long inventory with her about all the things I took and the credit cards. And I would use his, he had charge cards at a lot of places, and I would go and charge up, even at his men's store. And then I would sell them to people at the university for drinking money. There was a lot that he couldn't quite figure out, but he had a dossier on me. So when he came down to Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles, when I was 2.5 years sober, and walked me down the aisle to Boy Meets Girl in AA campus, he met all of you. We sat at the end of my wedding, someone took a picture, and we were eye to eye. Nahad, that was 2.5 years into my sobriety. Somebody snapped a shot, and me in my wedding garb, and my father in front of me, and I remember what he said. It's funny, because that whole day, your wedding day, can just kind of be a blur, but what my dad said to me is, Sharon, look at your life. You've got it made. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice. My dad was always about common sense. He told me I had none. which was true, which I would go out and prove him right every time. But I was going to say to my dad, well, it's about time you noticed. But you had given me enough humility with the steps and looking at myself and listening to my God first before I react, that I just looked at him and said, yeah, you're right, Dad. And we were eye to eye 2.5 years. And he came to the meeting. He saw all of you. He bought the big book. He had a great time, and he went home and read it. And when I called my father at 5 years of sobriety, because Jenny said it's time you call your dad to make financial amends to him, I thought, okay, just to appease her, you know, sponsors, goodness, I'm calling to tell you how mean my husband's being to me, and she's not even listening. Got a list by her phone that says, financial amends, time for Sharon to make them. So even if her foot's broken, we will do that next. We don't care. So Ginny said to me, call your dad. I did. He said, okay, great, it's this much. And he gave me a total right away. I think I kind of pulled the phone away and was shocked at the amount. It was like, whoa. I said, okay, I'll get back to you, Dad. And I called Ginny, and I said, Ginny, he said it's this much. And she said, okay, how about payment terms? I said, I don't think it's that much. And she said, were you keeping track? I said, no. So I called back, and my dad accepted my payment terms. So Ginny Gates, God bless her, she said, then you send your dad that money, but don't send the cold hard cash alone in an envelope. You tell your dad about your life. You send a note about your life with that check. And don't be late because Bill and Bob are watching. They get you, don't they? But see, this is the love of what we do for each other. We go that little extra mile. She didn't say, are you willing to heal with your dad? I would have said, it's not happening. Are you willing to have the innocence come back with your dad? I said, he knows too much about me. She didn't say that to me. She said, don't be late, send that check on time, put a note about your life in it, and then we'll see what happens. But don't be late. So she said, are you willing to grow through this with your dad? And that I could hear. Willing to grow through this with your dad. So I started at about 5 and I ended at about 10. At the end of my marriage, coincidentally. And my dad got a check and a note and a check and a note and a check and the note. She would say occasionally, did you tell him about your life? Yeah, the jail panel I went on, you know, the new cat I saved, or, you know, I didn't know what to tell him. He's got Miss Mensa, you know, and he's got all these, he goes to Alaska, he loves it, and, you know, and then he's me, the alcoholic, and rolling out to Southern California, where he just would, like, be sit on my lawn and read papers. He didn't want to even get on the road. He's just like, oh, you people are crazy out there. But it got easier remembering his birthday. It got easier sending Father's Day cards. It got easier going home. And my son was born in that time frame in there. And I started sponsoring a nun. I know. Really? She asked me and I went, there's nobody else back there. I guess she means me. It was like, really? Okay. So Sister Sheila would say, come meet me at Mass and we're gonna go to dinner. I gotta talk to you. So I would go at the end of Mass and they'd be talking about peace and love, and I would go, when did they start talking about peace and love there, you know? But Sister Sheila was there and my son was christened in my dad's grandfather, the grandfather I love, christening gowns from Prague, all handmade Battenberg. And my dad got to be there to watch my son, named after his father, get baptized. And that check and that note was going. And just by about 10 years, Christmas Day was the last Christmas with my husband. His parting gift to me was an alto saxophone. I thought that was pretty cool. But he did charge it, and I ended up doing a lot of the payments for it, so whatever. But day after Christmas, he called me and said, Sharon, I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes. I got to bring, because of you, forgiveness to that relationship because it was there between us. And redemption. What? I don't bring forgiveness and redemption. I bring my sad, sorry, I don't care about you rear end into the bar, push you away, and make sure I get my Jose Cuervo nice and neat to the top of that large rock glass and back it up right now, and no salt, no lime, just give me my tequila and get out of my way, and don't play any country and western on that jukebox, because I will be crying in your lap for the good times. Oh my God, that song, For the Good Times, over and over. Who's playing that song over and over? Shut up! You know, it's like, listen to the words, you know, it's like, or I'd be punching you in the face. I mean, it's just how wonderful I was as a human being in the world. I was gone. And now I'm bringing redemption to my father by my actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I get that privilege? How do we all get the privilege to have a brand new life here in recovery? A brand new beginning. August 20th, 1975, I sat above a liquor store drinking cheap wine through the place where my tooth had been kicked out, my jaw had been broken in three places, I was a victim of violent crime, I had a case, I had a detective, I had been drug around on the cement, I had been abused, and I don't remember much of it, and today when you were speaking, Ashley, you touched a part of me I haven't felt that I think needs to heal a little bit. I had the concussion. I was a mess. I had no feeling about it. And the guy that was letting me stay there said, you're depressing me. You have to leave. And I called my mother. And if my mother would have sent $10 more in the mail, you'd have another speaker, because she said to me, Sharon, I can't help you. Go to the Salvation Army. And she didn't know for two nights where I was and if I was okay. And by making amends to my family, by being a participant in their life, all those years that my mom got to live, she died at 95 last year, I told you when, on my husband's birthday. He was there to meet her with a rose. They liked each other a lot. I would take her to my dad. Because of that, you have given me a heart that is forever broken open. Forever broken open. And Hiller, when you were singing that song, I was looking at Mary Emma and the losses we have had of the loves of our lives. Many of you here with the losses of that I know with your children and the loved ones and your parents, people that we love in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hearts break open, but they heal bigger, and love never dies. Never. Love never dies. It can be transformed. And you have taught me how to do that. And my mother, when she was 94 years old, I heard her talking to somebody, and she said, there was only one time, because she was with it, that my husband, Frank, said, I couldn't help one of our children. And my ears perked up with that little comment. And I was not in the room where she was. And so I talked about that with her the next day. I said, Mom, we talked about the time that Dad wouldn't let you help one of your children. Can you tell me? She said, was it? She said it was. The day I called on August 20th, 1975. She had to put the phone on her chest because she wanted to help me. And she looked at my dad, and my dad said, we can't help her. We've already tried. So my mom said, where'd you get the Salvation Army thing, Mom? She said, I don't know. It just came. Because I hung up the phone, and I called the phone number there, and it was a woman who wasn't sober that day who got me to another person. But I didn't know. I was calling Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed a place to stay. I didn't have it. My sponsor said there was no friendly direction for me to go that day, and I was going to be homeless again. So that's how I got to you. A car came, put me in the back seat, couldn't get out, end up at a meeting. I don't know where I am. I'm in a church. Oh, yeah, they're going to talk about this. And, you know, me and God, we had a deal. I said, actually, one finger peace sign to my God, and I didn't want to be around him or have him around me anymore by God. And I went out of my way, godless, for many years of my drinking. And I was there at a church, and I thought, okay, now they're going to want something from me, because you always did. I had to pay for my mantra. I'm not paying. thing for my mantra. It's for fun and for free. It's about peace and love. What are you talking about, people? One finger seat, peace sign out the door. I was always searching, but it was never what I was searching for, ever. And I'm at this meeting, and I don't know what it is, but the man at the podium hooked me, and we have that hook in each one of us for somebody, and he hooked me, and I saw him once more before he died, but he hooked me. He was perfect for me that night. We may be the one that the newcomer hears it from. Maybe one of my girls said she was leaving AA again for the fourth or fifth time, never coming back, and she was walking out the door, and she heard a guy. She didn't know people's faces because she looked at their shoes. She had no self-worth. And she heard this guy say to somebody, whether he was sponsoring or not, but he was standing by the door as she was leaving forever, and she heard him say, "Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle." And a hook, she got a hook back in. So you don't know. I don't know what I'm going to say, if it's going to help somebody, if it's going to save a life. That's what we're here for. And the man at the podium said he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, "You can come home now, Bill." Spaceship people. I looked around at all of you and I thought I was with spaceship people. And I've been looking for you since I was six in those Iowa skies. I knew the mothership would come back and get me. So spaceship people. Okay. And then they ended up with this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and my journey began, and people gave me kindness, like sleeping on floors. My first 3 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't talk because I was wired shut. I had to learn to listen. And it was a blessing in disguise. I couldn't eat. It was just, I'd be at the coffee shop fellowshipping, and coffee would run out of my face, and that people would look at me like, "Oh, God," you know, it's like, "Do I have to take her home tonight?" But they didn't do that. They would clean up my face and put it on the table where I made a mess with the coffee and give me a wink and go back to their conversation. They treated me with kindness. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a bright spot in anybody's life, believe me. And my life started, and I got the privilege of working through the steps with a woman named Janet. And then when, you know, that first inventory was the hardest thing I ever did, and then we got to those defects of character, which was the whole list, was my soon-to-be husband's. And, you know, you want to know how you're doing, you ask, go home and ask the people, "How am I doing?" Ask your children, how's my program going here at home? And, you know, when we do go home, and I have to remember it, too, I go back to work Monday, they're not going to say, "Well, how was your weekend?" I was going to say, "Well, I was in Atlanta with all these wonderful people, and I learned a lot, and they're all seekers, and my soul got filled, and we cried, and we laughed, and we heard crazy jokes and singing, oh, my God." I'm just going to say, "It was fine, thank you. How was yours?" Because I have told a few jokes there, you know, around the water cooler, and they always look at me like, "Oh, yeah." She's dark, you know? Not funny jokes. Go to a Quentin Tarantino movie and sit there with your alcoholic friends, and there's nobody else laughing but you guys. You know what I mean? We are a little bodily and mentally different. So my amends to my father, just no more money, stop sending. Don't stop sending me the notes. "Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes." Those were his words. And Jenny said, "You will grow through this with your dad." And I did. And I got to go home and be with him and weed gardens and send his grandson home to him so he could learn how to swim and play tennis and weed a strawberry patch and drive a tractor and, you know, that kind of thing. Sit at night with the stars. And I was talking to my son, I don't know, it was just a while ago, and he said, "Mom, that river's scary." I thought, "Oh, you too? Oh, my God." It's like, I said, "Yeah, all the sounds, the owls and all kinds of things coming off that river, it's great. But if you're a little kid lying there at Grandma and Grandpa's house where, you know, he's awake and they're asleep because they go to bed early, he hears all those sounds." And he said, "I just kind of lay there and listen to all the sounds." So it was kind of fun to identify with my son on that, like Iowa, because he's an L.A. kid, you know, but he has a lot of grandpa and grandma in him, and what he does in life, people that meet me say, "You know, when I meet Wesley, I think he's not an L.A. kid. He seems like he's Midwest or something, and that's a nod to my mom and dad. That's a nod. They wanted him home. That was my amends, to send him to them every summer until I think he was about 15, and then my mom said, well, you don't need to send him anymore. I was like, I don't think he wants to be here anymore. But because of the good times with my father, because I got to sit down and at my father's feet with my son, who is in awe, and watch that man play his Heliganka accordion from Prague, I got to see the gleam in his eye as he got to watch Grandma make an apple pie. And 1999, I got a call. It was weird. I woke up that day. I'm extremely intuitive. Sometimes I thought more with my mom, but maybe so much with my dad, and I had a feeling of impending doom. And somebody said, what's wrong today? I said, I don't know. I have this feeling of impending doom, but it's not mine. And at about 3:33 in the afternoon, my dad went out on a small little John Deere. My dad had a construction business, changed tires and oil and engines on graders and all of big pieces of equipment he had, all his big yellow pieces. He made roads. He dug basements. He was on a hill trying to get some piece of rusted equipment off the property, and the tractor went over, and he was gone in a second. And I got to play my accordion, his accordion, at his wake. I got to play Amazing Grace for him. It took me all day to learn it, too, because it's buttons. He has buttons on both sides. Buttons. And I've not done any of this alone. None of it. And but my dad and I were good. I got to write him one more note, put my chip on it, and give it to him. Slide it in that drawer. And my marriage fell apart at 10 years. And, oh, boy, this is going to be amends. I'll tell you, this is not me. This is God. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is good sponsorship. This is people that would, they would let me sit in the room and be pissed off and angry. And it was, he became a punk rocker. And like the newcomer in the room who was a punk rocker took pictures of all those crazy guys. I tried. I went out with my husband and tried to a couple of Cramps concerts and, you know, trying to see where he was at in life. I ended up in Al-Anon because I used to put his records, Dead Kennedys, Fear, all of it in the oven and turn on the oven. And my Al-Anon sponsor, Marjorie Bernard, said, you got to go buy more records. I said, what? So I was learning to release him. I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and he was sitting in there learning to release me. And but he had this newcomer in the room, and everybody knew about it and didn't tell me. I'm 10 years sober. Now, I've made a lot of amends. I rescue dogs. I drive down the street, and they find me. There will be a street where you can't go right or left. It's in the middle. You're straight down, and it's sitting there. And it's just, it won't go. You honk, it won't go. You yell at it, it won't go. You open the door, it gets in. That happens to me all the time. So I have one rescue dog and two rescue cats right now, and that's, I find homes for them. I just got an email with somebody found a little black one, and I gave her someone to give them to, somebody I sponsor for about 5 months. Oh, boy, she's ready for a dog. And because when I come home, my dog goes, oh, my God, you're home. You're home. I'm so glad you're home. I've been waiting all weekends for you. I'm just so happy to see you. Excuse me. I got to go check my mail and come back, open the door. You're home. You're home. I'm so happy to see you. I'm just so glad you're here. You know, and I have the cat sitting there going, yeah, she's home. Where's the food? Just to have a little humility, right? But my Charlotte used to always say, you know what dogs feel backwards is, don't you? And so I know that when I show up to my God humbly or happily or sadly or joyously or for you or for me, when I just show up to my God, he goes, come, come, you're home. And you've given me that. Mends to the Catholic Church, sponsoring that nun. Showing up, being a part of it. Guess what they have every single year? It was on my list, couldn't find a way to do it. How do I make amends for that carnival? I mean, we were in Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri and Louisiana and Mississippi. All those little boys I ripped off. And made their nights bad. And I still probably talk about that mean carnival worker that they, you know, maybe I traumatized a couple. I have no idea. And when I, when my son got kicked out of kindergarten on another school, I called my sponsor crying. He said, send him to Sister Sheila. I said, I sponsor her. I don't care. Send him to Sister Sheila, who was the principal of a Catholic school. And that's where my son ended up going halfway through kindergarten. He had a rap sheet already. And guess what they have every spring to raise money for all of the extracurricular activities and the clubs? A school carnival. 3 days. Oh, I'd be happy to work there for you. I'll be happy to buy ride tickets for my son's friends. I'll be happy to go and all these attorneys that I work for, make them write me $100 checks. I mean, I had them so trained. By the time he graduated in eighth grade, I would just walk into the office at the end of May and they would go, oh yeah, who do I make it out to? How much is it again? I had them all trained. I made a serious attempt to make amends by working in that school carnival. The end of May, kindergarten through eighth grade. And that last year, they were all around me, my son's friends, because all the group got bigger. Oh, Wesley's mom buys ride tickets, you know. And they're all around me, and they're all taller than me now. And I just, as I gave up the tickets, I just thought, wow, it's done. Thank you, God, it's done. The universe will show you a way. Show you a way. And that that marriage that fell apart, and that girl Jill, newcomer, chubby, just a little pigeon-toed, but so I had my, so we're broken up. Everybody knew. I'm betrayed. The people in my group, I landed in the Pacific group. I'm still in the Pacific group. I had no idea where I was. I would have fled, I'm sure. But I put down my roots there. And my roots have entwined with your roots like aspen trees. You know, we're one big root. We're all one big root. You can see the aspen grow from space. There's such a big one in Colorado because it's one big root. Together we're powerful. I think it was Mildred that said to me, you can do things I can't do. I can do things you can't do, but together we can do great things. We're one big root. So I was entwined with you, and I couldn't get away. And thank God I sat in the front row with my cramped shirt on, my doll. It said my doll. I probably didn't have that anymore, but that was my punk rocker shirt. And I cut my hair and made it Madonna white, and it was all spiky and gelled, so that meant don't touch me. I'm 10 years sober, and my old-timer, have a lot of respect for a lady named Pat, who was in the CIA. She was kind of scary, actually. She walked by with a newcomer and said, look at Sharon, she's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got? And I knew it was a newcomer, and I knew I wasn't being a Bill and Bob example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard her. And I didn't throw the hot coffee on them that night because I was on my way, because they were too happy. It was date night, you know. And I didn't, and my sponsor took the keys out of my hand, the spare keys to his car, because I was going to drive it. Venice, low tide, that would have been some amends to make for that car at low tide in Venice as the tide came in. I was ready for that. And I did another inventory, and I thought, I'll never make amends to these people. I'll do the inventory. We'll read it, and you can just keep me in line, Clancy, because my sponsor went to Paris and smoked pot and gave up 21 years. A lot of respect for that Paris thing. And when I picked her up at the international terminal, she had 21 days. It broke my heart. So here I am with this man. I don't know if I like him. I don't know if he likes me. He said, we'll try. And we've been trying for 30 of my 40 years. And he's been perfect for me because he's been louder than my head when I need him. And he's been kind and gentle and loving. And when my mother came up for my 30th birthday party, Johnny and Clancy practically genuflected at her feet. It was awesome to watch them and how they treated her. And she laughed at their jokes and thought they were funny. And It was beautiful to watch. And Sybil actually brought my mother to hear me for the first time talk in Des Moines, Iowa. Sybil was living in the basement. We couldn't get rid of Sybil. Finished her education at the University of Iowa and lived in my mother's basement and took good care of her. And drove to Des Moines, so I think my son was there. You were bringing him back to me so he could come back on the plane with me. And driving home, Sybil said, she said to Marge, my mom, well, what do you think of that? They sat, Marge, between Pat and Cliff Roach, so she had the alcoholic on one side and the Al-Anon on the other side, just in case. And I remember I was talking about the patch, and I kind of looked over and, oh, my God, you didn't know about that, did you? It's like, But Sybil asked my mom driving home, well, what'd you think of that, Marge? I think she said, well, I think Sharon's the best talker this family has. I think she's the best speaker this family has. And the next time I saw my mom, we were somewhere together, and it was beautiful, and it was north of Chicago in a beautiful lake, and she was there. And I said, Mom, if you're going to hear me today, do you want me to leave anything out? I don't want to hurt you. And she said, because you've given me that awareness. And she said, no, there's just always some surprises. So my amends to my mom and dad were paramount in my life. And Jill, that whole thing. Now, this is redemption for my dad. I thought the amends were just for me, right? I walk down on the sunny side of the street. I don't have to worry anymore about somebody. You know, I used to, when anybody called me with a southern accent and called me Cher, made me a little nervous. Somebody from my past, hey, Cher. You know, I was like, oh, God, who are you and do I owe you money? You know, And I have a listed phone number, and it's still the same phone number I've had for 40 years. It's now a Google voice, but I got it. I kept it so people can find me. AA people from the past, whoever needs to find me, you can find me. But, that whole thing with my dad and the redemption, because I called him every Sunday night. My marriage is over. They know that. They're sad. They, you know, they're sorry. They liked him. He was, you know, good to me, and I was good to him, but he wanted something different. And so I called my dad and said, I threw a rod in the car. The car died on the freeway, or I was just getting off the freeway. And he said, oh, I'm so glad and that you weren't on the road. And, you know, his grandson's in the car, and I had to go back to work, and I didn't know anything much except I was showing up for meetings and trying to be a good mom. And my son had night tremors, and I have to sit up with him all night long, rocking him. And I had to do another inventory, and I wasn't ready to forgive them at all, believe me. But took a long time. And my dad said, yeah, I threw a rod once with this truck, and we talked about it and laughed. And then 2 days later, I get a phone call from my dad. And he said, this is after my financial amends are all done. About 2 years later. And he said, your mom and I were at the bank, and the bank has got an extra car. And we looked at it. We think it might be good for you and Wesley. And so we're going to drive it out. My daddy in Iowa, my mommy in Iowa, packed up her pickled beets and everything else that Don Newcomb had to have. He always had to have Marge's pickled beets and everything else for me, and packed it up and drove that car out. And it was, I took a car from my dad. I took from my dad. It was redemption for him to be a daddy with his little girl in trouble. It was redemption for him to help me out. He didn't have to look at my mom and go, we can't, we've tried. So he drove out a Ford Galaxy four-door with deer whistles on it. 7,000 miles, a great car. And people would look at me and go, what are those things on your car? I would say they're my beam-me-up whistles for the mothership. redemption from my father. He didn't even hesitate to be my daddy. So glad we were there. I'm so glad I had a sponsor that said, basically what a sponsor does is just lift you up to the next rock. You know, come sit on this rock with me. The view is more beautiful. And every single time I have walked through a hallway, because I haven't left you, I've just gone from room to room with hallways sometimes. And I've learned in the hallway that you're not alone. There's other people suffering. There's other people hurting. There's other people that need a smile. There's other people, other people, other people. Or play some music, go to a movie, open some windows, buy a plant, get a cat. But get through the hallway. The door will open. And my sponsor, Ginny, God bless her, she said, when you see a crack in that door opening, you run over and stick your boot in it and pry it open. So you can have a new view. And every new view from every hallway I've ever walked through because of you has been more beautiful than the one I left behind. It is not my little designs and plans. It is God's love. It is God's love. So I got that with my family. And my ex, we went to, how they come is how they go. So he did leave her after she had a baby. It was about a year and a half old. The same time he left when my son was a year and a half old. So how they come is how they go, I've learned sometimes, you know. My sponsor that night, he took the hot coffee out of my hands and saw where I was going with it. I gave up the keys to the spare car that night. He says, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace. And then he added the words I could hear, so you can be an example to others. Dignity and grace, I want revenge. I don't care. I don't care how I look to all of you right now. You betrayed me. I hate all of you anyway, but be an example, Bill and Bob. The respect for what we have here. The respect for what you've given me. The respect for the transformation that you have allowed me to have within you. And I was sitting in there having the pain, but I was transforming without even knowing it. That's why the rear view mirror is small and the front windshield is big. But as one of my girls said, yeah, but I'm always looking at my lipstick in the rear view mirror. It's like, we do that too. But life is lived forward, and you've helped me with that through so many tough times. And that woman that he married, that he left, said, because we got to know each other because of the kids. She said, you know what? After he left, I knew I could do it because I watched you. So I don't get to judge who gets my example even here. And she will give me a cake in August. We spent Mother's Day together. We are good friends. Good friends. And we are better for having known him in our life because we both have wonderful boys. And he's not around, but he's in sober, but I don't know what he does. He lives in another state. But he was there for my son's first communion with Sister Sheila in the church. And he showed up, and then we went to lunch, and he didn't come to lunch, and we got a call that he had had a heart attack. So my son and I went over to St. John's Hospital, where my son was born. And I said, you know, he might look funny, he might look pale, he might not look like himself, he might have tubes. I kind of told my son how it might be, and we walk in, and my son goes right up to his dad and holds his hand and talks to him, and I'm like, you know, I got hit with something. And our friend Cindy was there reading in the big book, you know, and he was getting prepped and figuring out what they were going to do. And Cindy and Wesley went off to get something to eat, and I was there alone with him. Him. I was just kind of sitting there, and then all of a sudden he started having leg cramps. His legs were going crazy, and he was in pain and having leg cramps. So I'm pushing the button. I'm pushing that button. I'm looking out the door, nurse, nurse, pushing that button. I took lifeguard. I know CPR. I know what to do. I whipped up that blanket on his legs, and I started rubbing out his leg cramps. I had to touch him. And I didn't even think, really. I didn't even think. I just did what I had to do it as I was rubbing on his leg cramps and he was getting some relief. I had some relief too. Right place at the right time. So that was a moment.
That was a sacred moment.
I've had so many sacred moments. One being my sweetheart, Casey, and I had to make a lot of living amends to my husband at times too, because I am type double A, double Leo alcoholic. He's a Virgo, and so everything needs to be in place except you open his office. It was like, whoa, but he knew where everything was. It was crazy. When I was cleaning out his office, my husband loved to read, and he loved to share, and he was funny, and he was smart, and he would have he had taken a big marker and written the page number of the article he thought I would enjoy on the front of every New Yorker for me to find. Little things like that. And when we were going to elope and we weren't going to tell anyone, I started inviting the world, right? And it's his brother and his brother's high school sweetheart who got together after divorce, and one was a widow, and my husband and me and my son walked us down the aisles, and we stayed at the Bellagio, and we eloped. But I am calling people to invite them to a chapel that holds like 7 people or something, right? And he just heard me on the phone, and he went, wait a minute. And he sat down and said to me again, we're keeping this quiet, and there's not going to, Ronnie and John aren't inviting anyone, and you're inviting everybody. You're inviting your 10 best friends. And, I just felt like, he said, Sharon, I know you get excited. But I had to call people and uninvite them, and one had already bought her plane ticket, and I had to eat crow right then and there. And I don't know about you, but it doesn't taste good. But eat it when it's warm. Do it right away, because when it's cold, it gets even worse. So you eat crow when it's warm, and I did. And it didn't taste good, but I didn't taint that day by being excitable and selfish and self-centered. And it was a beautiful moment. It was a beautiful day. It was a lot of fun. It was everything I wanted. I never thought we were together 24 years and married 5. Because neither one of us wanted that paperwork, you know. But we were committed, and we were together. And we went to the oncologist one day, and we knew he had had some problems, and a malignant melanoma started on his head, got inside him before we could catch it. And we sat there, and I'm so glad we started out. There was nothing to be said, just even that moment walking in then, because we lived life, we loved life, we had an open door for people in Alcoholics Anonymous and family and friends and whatever else needed to happen. Yeah, we had our stuff, but we were committed to each other. We didn't go to bed mad. We prayed together. We meditated together. That was awesome. And we said, well, you know, what's the prognosis? How long? He said to him, how long do I have? And he said, 7 months. And that's a day. That's a day you want to make sure you're current, right? That's a day. We both looked at each other and he said 7 years, right? We both said it at the same time to each other because he said 7 years, right? And no, 7 months. And life changed in a heartbeat. It got sweeter. It got more beautiful. It got deeper. There wasn't anything that we didn't have to say to each other. We got to live our life one day at a time, one morning at a time, one moment at a time, one trip to Ireland at a time so he could play golf while he was still feeling good. We went off to Sweden. We went to Australia. We lived. And he didn't feel good. And he was courageous, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that, because I get a cold. It's like, I can't even get out of bed. I'm such a baby. I don't get sick very often. When I'm sick, I'm like, ugh. And he bucked up, because he didn't even want me to go to his chemo treatments with him. He brought people he sponsored. He said, Sharon, go to work. Keep the insurance. We laughed a lot. Unbelievable how much we laughed. You were all there. You were all there that day. You were all there that walk. You were all there for, we got 2 years and 2 months out of it. You were there. And he was an example of dignity and grace sitting in his seat at the home group every Wednesday night, whether he felt like it or not. And you didn't come talk to him about his cancer. You talked to him about your day. Because we lift each other up to a new view. I can't do it alone. Angels with broken wings can't fly alone. I remember hearing that somewhere. I need your lift. I have a broken wing much of the time. I'm excited to be alive and sober and in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. These promises, my friend Sandy used to say, it's a magic show.
Self-seeking will slip away.
That's magic. How does it just self-seeking slip away? You know, you don't even see it's going. It's slipping. I love it. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change right here at the end of step 8 and 9. But we have to be painstaking about this phase of our development. It's not easy, but it's worth it. Living life isn't even easy, but it's worth it. And you've given me the grace to have some lilt in my step every single day, even when I'm in grief. Even when I'm sad, and I'm going to tell you this little story because it's kind of important. After my husband passed away, for some reason, the place I've worked for many years, I've been there 14 years now, some reason, they didn't handle me right. They didn't really have any compassion for me. I don't know what happened. There was a miscommunication and the HR department was weak, and I really kind of want to write a book on how to treat people when this goes on. And I came back and I sat in front of my boss and he said, Sharon, if you can't do your job, please let me know. What? I'm sorry this happened to you. No pause. But if you can't do your job, please let me know. I felt like he just twisted something inside of my broken open heart. And I went back to my desk and I didn't know how to turn on my computer. I didn't know what to do. It was a whole new life without him. And almost 3 years, I would turn that corner, go into work, and I would see that building and fight or flight, fight or flight, fight or flight. Hated that man, hated that job, hated where I went. Have to work on that program and read and remember and call and just work so hard to get into my office and do what I was supposed to do with a decent attitude. And I supervise people and try not to let them know. And I could close my door and talk to you. I could go to a noon meeting. I could take care of myself. And that man, I thought, let me try this kind of thing on him. And he didn't know I hated him. He didn't know because he called me in the office. He said, close the door. He said, I'm just telling my friends this. He thinks I'm a friend. But I'm not going to be your boss anymore. And tears of joy leaped in my eyes. Leap. I'd never had that happen before. And he gave me a Kleenex and went, oh, it's going to be okay. And I didn't have to make amends to him for all that. But it was like, oh, my God, thank you, God, because I can fake it if I have to out there in the world and not have to make amends. You know, it rains on the just and the unjust, and I take what you've given me out into the world. I look for people to help. I am part of the force for good today. You have given me everything. My life is your life. We are connected here together. I used to think freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Freedom is knowing that God loves us. God has given us a chance to save a life. My husband used to go and look for the effects of God. He wasn't feeling very well, and he didn't see God in his cancer. But he would go out in the world and look for the effects of God. And so that's what he taught me to do. I go out in the world every single day of my life and look for the effects of God, and it's all over this room. I love you. Thank you.